Because he felt an exultant desire to laugh, as he had laughed at the news of Wyatt's fire, as he had laughed at the crash of Dunconia Copper, and knew that if he did, the thing he feared would hold him, would not release him this time, and he would never see his mills again. Reardon drew back, and for a moment kept his lips closed tight to utter no sound. When the moment was over, he said quietly, his voice firm and dead, "Take that gold of yours and get away from here. I won't accept the help of a criminal." Donnischild's face showed no reaction. "I cannot force you to accept the gold, Mr. Reardon, but I will not take it back. You may leave it lying where it is if you wish. I don't want your help, and I don't intend to protect you. If I were within reach of a phone, I would call the police. I would, and I will, if you ever attempt to approach me again. I'll do it, in self-protection." "I understand exactly what you mean. You know, because I've listened to you, because you've seen me eager to hear it, that I haven't damned you as I should. I can't damn you or anyone else. There are no standards left for men to live by, so I don't care to judge anything they do today, or in what manner they attempt to endure the unendurable. If this is your manner, I will let you go to hell in your own way. But I want no part of it. Neither is your inspiration, nor is your accomplice. Don't expect me ever to accept your bank account, if it does exist. Spend it on some extra armor plate for yourself, because I'm going to report this to the police and give them every clue I can to set them on your trail." Donnischild did not move or answer. A freight train was rolling by somewhere in the distance and darkness. They could not see it, but they heard the pounding beat of wheels filling the silence. And it seemed close, as if a disembodied train, reduced to a long string of sound, were going past them in the night. "You wanted to help me in my most hopeless hour?" said Reardon. "If I'm brought to where my only defender is a pirate, then I don't care to be defended any longer. You speak some remnant of a human language, so in the name of that I'll tell you that I have no hope left. But I have the knowledge that when the end comes I will have lived by my own standards, even while I was the only one to whom they remained valid. I will have lived in the world in which I started, and I will go down with the last of it. I don't think you'll want to understand me, but—" A beam of light hit them with the violence of a physical blow. The clangor of the train had swallowed the noise of the motor, and they had not heard the approach of the car that swept out of the side road from behind the farmhouse. They were not in the car's path, yet they heard the screech of brakes behind the two headlights, pulling an invisible shape to a stop. It was Reardon who jumped back involuntarily, and had time to marvel at his companion. The swiftness of Donnischild's self-control was that he did not move. It was a police car, and it stopped beside them. The driver leaned out. "Oh, it's you, Mr. Reardon," he said, touching his fingers to his cap. "Good evening, sir."
"Hello," said Reardon, fighting to control the unnatural abruptness of his voice.
There were two patrolmen in the front seat of the car, and their faces had a tight look of purpose, not the look of their usual friendly intention to stop for a chat. "Mr. Reardon, did you walk from the mills by way of Edgewood Road past Blacksmith Cove?"
"Yes, why?"
"Did you happen to see a man anywhere around these parts, a stranger moving along in a hurry?"
"Where?"
"He'd be either on foot or in a battered wreck of a car that's got a million-dollar motor."
"What man?"
"A tall man with blonde hair."
"Who is he?"
"You wouldn't believe it if I told you, Mr. Reardon. Did you see him?" Reardon was not aware of his own questions, only of the astonishing fact that he was able to force sounds past some beating barrier inside his throat. He was looking straight at the policeman, but he felt as if the focus of his eyes had switched to his side vision, and what he saw most clearly was Donnischild's face watching him with no expression, with no lines, no muscles worth a feeling. He saw Donnischild's arms hanging idly by his sides, the hands relaxed, with no sign of intention to reach for a weapon, leaving the tall, straight body defenseless and open, open as to a firing squad. He saw in the light that the face looked younger than he had thought, and that the eyes were sky blue. He felt that his one danger would be to glance directly at Donnischild, and he kept his eyes on the policeman, on the brass buttons of a blue uniform. But the object filling his consciousness more forcefully than a visual perception was Donnischild's body, the naked body under the clothes, the body that would be wiped out of existence. He did not hear his own words, because he kept hearing a single sentence in his mind,
without context, except the feeling that it was the only thing that mattered to him in the world. If I should lose my life, to what better purpose could I give it?
Did you see him, Mr. Reardon?
No, said Reardon. I didn't. The policeman shrugged regretfully and closed his hands about the steering wheel.
You didn't see any man that looked suspicious?
No.
Nor any strange car passing you on the road?
No. The policeman reached for the starter.
They got word that he was seen ashore in these parts tonight, and they've thrown a dragnet over five counties. We're not supposed to mention his name, not to scare the folks. But he's a man whose head is worth $3 million in rewards from all over the world.
He had pressed the starter, and the motor was churning the air with bright cracks of sound, when the second policeman leaned forward. He had been looking at the blonde hair under Donnershold's cap.
"Who is that, Mr. Reardon?" he asked.
"My new bodyguard," said Reardon.
"Oh, a sensible precaution, Mr. Reardon, in times like these.
Good night, sir."
The motor jerked forward. The red taillights of the car went shrinking down the road. Donnershold watched it go, then glanced pointedly at Reardon's right hand. Reardon realized that he had stood facing the policeman with his hand, clutching the gun in his pocket, and that he had been prepared to use it. He opened his fingers and drew his hand out hastily. Donnershold smiled. It was a smile of radiant amusement, the silent laughter of a clear young spirit, greeting a moment it was glad to have lived. And although the two did not resemble each other, the smile made Reardon think of Francisco d'Anconia.
"You haven't told a lie," said Ranier Donnershold. "Your bodyguard. That's what I am and what I'll deserve to be, in many more ways than you can know at present.
Thanks, Mr. Reardon, and so long. We'll meet again much sooner than I had hoped." He was gone before Reardon could answer. He vanished beyond the stone fence as abruptly and soundlessly as he had come. When Reardon turned to look through the farm field, there was no trace of him, and no sign of movement anywhere in the darkness. Reardon stood on the edge of an empty road, in a spread of loneliness vaster than it had seemed before. Then he saw, lying at his feet, an object wrapped in burlap, with one corner exposed, and glistening in the moonlight, the color of the pirate's hair. He bent, picked it up, and walked on. Kip Chalmers swore as the train lurched and spilled his cocktail over the tabletop. He slumped forward, his elbow in the puddle, and said,
"God damn these railroads, what's the matter with their track? You'd think with all the money they've got, they'd disgorge a little, so we wouldn't have to bump like farmers on a hay cart."
His three companions did not take the trouble to answer. It was late, and they remained in the lounge merely because an effort was needed to retire to their compartments. The lights of the lounge looked like feeble portholes in a fog of cigarette smoke, dank with the odor of alcohol. It was a private car, which Chalmers had demanded and obtained for his journey. It was attached to the end of the Comet, and it swung like the tail of a nervous animal as the Comet coiled through the curves of the mountains.
"I'm going to campaign for the nationalization of the railroads," said Kip Chalmers, glaring defiantly at a small gray man who looked at him without interest. "That's going to be my platform plank. I've got to have a platform plank. I don't like Jim Taggart. He looks like a soft-boiled clam. To hell with the railroads. It's time we took them over."
"Go to bed," said the man, "if you expect to look like anything human at the big rally tomorrow.
Do you think we'll make it?"
"You've got to make it."
"I know I've got to, but I don't think we'll get there on time. This goddamn snail of a super special is hours late."
"You've got to be there, Kip," said the man ominously, in that stubborn monotone of the unthinking, which asserts an end without concern for the means.
"God damn you, don't you suppose I know it?"